You're now listening to Adulting with Vicky. It's a coming-of-age podcast about millennials navigating adulthood. I'll talk about anything from life after college to bridging generational gaps, social media, and most importantly, being your best self. Join me, Vicky Nguyen, as I figure out how to be an adult.
You ever have those moments where you want to start a project or you want to do something and then you kind of start to overthink, and then it becomes a domino effect of where you just keep coming up with more reasons not to do something, or you're worried about failure or not executing it to the standard that you want, and for that reason you just choose not to do it because you figure better if I take it safe than do a crappy job. Well, I actually am trying really hard to move away from that because I don't think fear of failure should stop you from it, because the thing is, we learn from our mistakes. And as humans, you know, we have a lot of things that are imperfect, and in a way that is what makes all of us special. So for today, I have a special guest, Lisa Lewis, who will be talking to us about her experience with perfectionism and her whole take on it. So hey, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Vicky, and hello to adulting listeners. It's so awesome to get the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Okay, so before we get into the topic, who are you, Lisa? What do you do? What are you into outside of work and everything? I want to know who you are.
Well, let me start with who I am in work, and then we'll get into some of the other parts of my identity too, because I think that's such a juicy way to think about oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So by day, my 9-to-5, I am a woman on a mission to try to help individuals find more fun and happiness in their work. And I do that by being an independent career coach and running my business, where I work with folks who are ambitious, they're analytical, they are high achievers, high performers, and they're really hard on themselves, and figuring out how they can take all the things that drive joy and aliveness and fun and wrap that into some potential new directions and new evolutions for their work. So, and that's how I got into the world of starting to wrestle with and unravel perfectionism. I think about myself as a recovering perfectionist in that way. But outside of my 9-to-5 and my recovering perfectionism, which I'm sure we'll get into in a minute,
mm-hmm.
I am also a resident of Boulder, Colorado.
Awesome.
And I'm a competitive singer. I sing with a competitive barbershop a cappella quartet.
Oh my gosh, and that's amazing.
Thank you. We are part of the Sweet Adelines organization of female barbershop singers, and my quartet and I just got back from international competition maybe a week ago.
What? Oh my gosh. Sorry. I'm a little fangirling right now.
Well, I mean, if we want to talk about recovering perfectionism, that could be a good place to dive in too, because it is really hard and really scary and really vulnerable to stand up on a stage with three other women where you are the only person singing your part. It's a cappella, so there is no piano, there's no instrumentation to try to help you if you are losing your pitch or losing the tempo. And they're relying on you, and they need you to show up at the very best that you can do. So it's a really interesting tension between wanting to give everything and leave it out there on the stage and show up as perfect, with also knowing that perfection isn't possible and it's not human. And part of the magic and the beauty of making live music, which you as a former violinist probably know very well,
uh-huh.
is it's in the ability to react and respond and be dynamic and to go with the flow and to pick things up if something gets a little funky or lost, or if you lose the tempo.
Yeah, and we got that's exactly why I love jazz music, because you don't, like, the whole thing with jazz is there's just so much improvising, and you know, you don't have to chase perfection. It's so freeing, which is not what I played when I played violin at all. With classical music, you know, there's an exact type of way that you needed to play a certain note, and you had to play it at the exact time that the score says, because if you don't, it's going to throw off the rest of the orchestra.
Yeah, 100%. Well, and one of the other things about jazz that I love too is this concept of a blue note. Like, it's a note you're adding into the music that mm-hmm. is being played that by many accounts doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Or it makes a funky or a weird chord, or it doesn't make the chord everybody else was sort of moving towards.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't call it a mistake. We don't call it a problem.
Yeah.
We don't call it an imperfection. You just call it a blue note.
Yeah. And it's intentional, which is so cool because, you know, someone else might not even expect it. And you're just like, whoop, here it is.
Just putting it out there as courageously and visibly and vulnerably as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then how has perfectionism played into you being part of this barbershop quartet?
Yeah, well, so I will actually probably start this conversation with the assertion that almost every single person on the planet has a streak of perfectionism in there.
Mm.
We just may not call it that or may not recognize that that's the force that it's playing inside of us in our internal decision making.
Mm-hmm.
But if anybody who is listening has ever put pressure on themselves to do things the right way, as if there was one perfect way to do something and everything else was wrong, you might have a little streak of perfectionism. Or if you have ever been so hard on yourself about things that are pretty human,
mm-hmm.
or that are things that you would actually be totally compassionate about in your friends or in your coworkers, you might have a streak of perfectionism going on. And I think, you know, if you find yourself in situations in life where you're looking for the one true answer or you're treating it like it's black and white,
mm-hmm.
you know, we all know exactly like what you said at the beginning of this conversation, that there's no such thing as perfection. And there's no such thing as the one singular right way to do things. But if you find yourself continuing to look for that or hope for that, and have a lot of fear around if you don't find that, you probably have a little hint of perfectionism going on in there. It usually leads you to that analysis paralysis that you were describing too. And one of the cool things about analysis paralysis is that it's usually coming from a place of your integrity and your fear intersecting inside of your body. Because you want to do a really great job at something,
mm-hmm.
but you're also very afraid of what happens if you don't do a really great job. So these two forces start to interplay with each other. And your integrity asks you to keep analyzing, to keep gathering more data, to keep asking more people, to seek out advice, to take that class, to try out, you know, XYZ intellectual things to try to help you make a decision. And then the fear keeps pulling you tightly and tightly to not make a move that's wrong or bad or imperfect. And then you get totally stuck inside your own brain.
That has totally happened to me on several accounts. And you're right. I think everyone really does have at least a little bit of a perfectionist inside of them, or that they're seeking it. Because if you have never worried about that, I want to meet you. Because you are probably so confident in yourself. And I want to know how you do that. Because that is something I think everyone needs a little bit of.
Well, speaking about confidence is actually a really interesting thing, Vicky, because there is a coach out there. His name is Dan Sullivan, and he has this 4C framework where he talks about confidence, which I like blew my mind the first time I heard it. And his framework is that confidence and capability are the outcomes, that they are not the things that actually get you to start taking action or growing or learning when there's growth or a challenge ahead of you. But if you're confident or if you're capable, it's because you've already mastered whatever you're asking yourself to do and you're not growing or getting challenged or pushed. But in order to gain the confidence and the competence, which we all want,
mm-hmm.
you start on the other side with courage and with commitment. Not commitment to an outcome, a specific outcome happening,
mm-hmm.
but commitment to your courage and commitment to trying the process. And so I think that actually the people in the world who don't have any perfectionism
mm-hmm.
might just have a ton of courage and a ton of commitment and may not actually have any confidence.
Wow.
They may be totally contented to say, you know what? I know there's so much for me to learn and grow. And I know that I hardly know anything.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than putting pressure on myself to be the best or to be right,
mm-hmm.
let me just very humbly try and see what happens.
Oh my gosh, that's such a wonderful way of putting it. What's the name of the coach again that you just mentioned?
His name is Dan Sullivan.
Dan Sullivan.
Is an episode of his podcast. I think it's called the 10X Podcast.
The 10X Podcast. Okay. That's an amazing way of putting it because that is actually so true. When you humbly approach something and not focus so much on whether something will be a quote unquote success, you're going to try more. And then by trying more things, the outcome is that you will have the confidence in yourself, not going into it already being confident. Is that the right way?
Yeah, absolutely. And that expectations piece you brought up is so key, Because when you put expectations on yourself that something is going to turn out a certain way, or mm-hmm. you're going to perform at a certain level, that's where some of that perfectionistic pressure and the analysis paralysis both start to creep in. So noticing when you're going into something and you have an expectation that you're going to be great at it, or that it's going to be amazing or perfect or the best day ever, you know, you're setting yourself up so that almost any outcome is going to be a negative one and a bad one and a less than perfect one. And that's no fun to live that way, you know?
It isn't. And on the flip side, I've heard of some people who, and this is more closely to related to when people are applying to a job or they're interested in dating someone and they're just saying like, oh, I'm going to go into this with no expectation so that I may not get disappointed in some way. But how do you feel about when people flip it that whole way and don't set an expectation or some type of goal or standard?
Oh, that's such an intuitive question, Vicky, because when you flip it to that extreme end of the spectrum and you just say, I don't care, I have no expectations, sometimes that's actually fear's way of protecting you on the opposite side by trying to pretend like you don't actually care. Because why on earth would you be doing anything in your life that you don't care about, right? Life is way too short for any of that BS.
Yeah.
Like, you should always be doing things in your life that you care about. But what you just mentioned is a great segue into talking about where healthy expectation setting comes from and talking a little bit about fixed mindsets and growth mindsets and the work that the fabulous Carol Dweck has done around better understanding where perfectionism and pressures come from and how we can take a drive to do well and to perform well, but have it in a really healthy way rather than a really destructive, painful, high stakes, high pressure way.
I love that. So, okay. So before we reframe this whole thing with expectations and perfectionism, you mentioned before it's rooted in something. So where does that come from?
So the root of perfectionism, or one of them, you know, anytime you're talking in absolutes, you're probably putting yourself at more likelihood of falling into a perfectionistic trap. So certainly one of the places where perfectionism can come from is an identity status. So when you think about when you were a teeny tiny baby back in the day, and your family and your teachers and people around you were giving you feedback, that time was so formative because you were learning a lot about who you were relative to the world, and you were learning about your identity. Right? That identity isn't just tied in work, or it isn't just tied in your hobbies.
Mm-hmm.
And when people around you were talking to you as a little kid, there are two different types of modalities in which you might have gotten feedback. Let's say that you were sitting in a corner mm-hmm. and you had your book and you were flipping through it, sitting there all by yourself. An adult in your life could have looked at you and said, oh my goodness, Vicky, you are such a good little reader. And when you get feedback phrased in that way, you are a good reader. What you're hearing and what you're internalizing from that young age is that this thing that you're doing, reading, mm-hmm. is your identity. You are a reader.
Mm.
And it isn't just that you're a reader. They've actually put a superlative in there, right? Mm-hmm. They labeled you as being a good reader, which then means that your identity has become that you have to be good at this thing.
Because they say you are this, and thus you kind of want to continue holding up that status.
Yeah, absolutely. Because how would you, as a sweet little 4-year-old or 5-year-old or 6-year-old, you know, how would you know any different? You don't have any other mental models. You haven't been given context or mental health coping tools or anything else to be able to better identify yourself. So you take that feedback and that external information from the environment and you internalize it, that this is who I am. But when you take on an identity, like I am a good reader, then all of a sudden you walk yourself into this interesting conundrum where if anything happens in your life that creates a data point that doesn't support that you are a good reader, it becomes psychologically threatening to you. So say that you get to high school and you're taking a history class, and you're just sucking in that history class because you're trying to read and memorize all the names and dates and places and sequences,
mm-hmm.
and it's just not happening for you. That might make it so that you hate history because the reading you were doing in that history wasn't working well. You weren't good at it. And therefore, history becomes a psychological threat to your identity. And so you then make decisions about your life where you might cut that out of your life. And you might choose not to do any history at all. So there's a flip side of identity here that I want to talk about too, which is that you could be that same sweet little 5-year-old kiddo sitting in a corner with your book and have somebody say, look at you, I'm noticing you're reading all by yourself, or look at you flipping those pages on your own. And when you get that feedback about the exact same situation, instead of saying you are a thing, it's instead saying you are doing a thing. I am noticing and observing an activity that you're doing. So now the reading isn't your identity, but you are getting feedback that people notice when you're taking action and that you're growing and you're doing things independently by yourself. And it's so subtle, but it's so important in its difference, because when you're thinking about things through that lens, having it be part of growth and not part of identity means that you have so much more space to evolve and change as a person, because you're not fixed into a specific identity. And this is actually all the work that Carol Dweck, who I was just talking about, really codified in her work and in her TED Talk, where she talks about the fixed mindset versus the growth mindset.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, it is a fabulous tool. It's going to blow your mind. I love it. So the fixed mindset is exactly that person who takes on what they do as who they are. And where things that don't match up with who they are a threat and a problem. The growth mindset is where what you do is just what you do, and you can start doing something or stop doing something or change doing something, and it's not a psychological threat. So when you think about trying something new, like being in that history class, somebody with a fixed mindset who was told, I'm a good reader, probably goes in with the expectation that they're going to be a really good reader. And when that doesn't pan out, then they're putting all this pressure on themselves to have lived up to that perfect standard, that it's too painful and too hard, and they cut this part out of their life that could be really amazing and wonderful.
Yeah.
Somebody who was affirmed for doing things might walk into that same history class with the growth mindset and think, okay, whatever I'm doing with trying to learn these names and dates isn't working, but I know I can do something differently. So let me try a different tactic. Maybe I don't want to read at all. Maybe I want to do flashcards. Or maybe I want to read a different book about history to help better internalize this and learn this. And so coming in with the expectation of, I want to learn and I want to grow, as opposed to I want to get it right and have it meet my expectations from the very get-go, results in two totally different ways of being in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think even by having that type of mindset where you're thinking about doing it versus to comply with an identity that you feel forced on you, or that you feel you are scared to move out of, this kind of shapes it in a way where you don't even want to do it just to be successful. Sometimes you just want to do it to try it. For then this doesn't even have to be just career-wise too. It could be hobbies. Like if you want to try rock climbing, no expectation that you need to be successful or good, just so you can see if you can do it.
Totally. Well, and you're bringing up a great point, which is that for most people, you're not 100% fixed or 100% growth. There are usually certain areas in your life where you tend to lean towards one of those two more often than the other. But we are, you know, dynamic, creative, evolving, amazing human beings. So we have a little bit of each in us. But you may notice when you think about your own life, specific places where pressure and expectations and perfectionism and all that stuff tends to show up for you. And that may be a really good hint that you've been approaching it through a fixed point of view. And you may notice in your life places where growth comes really easily. Like, for example, people usually with their hobbies have a very growth-focused mindset of, let me just try this to see if it's any fun and see if I enjoy it and see what comes from me trying to do this thing. And that's what makes hobbies so lovely and enjoyable.
So then how do you think people can apply that to their careers? Because they want to reach a certain expectation that they set for themselves or that their boss sets for themselves so that they can try and move up or succeed and learn more in another position.
Well, career, I think, is one of the most interesting places to wrestle with perfectionism and fixed mindsets secretly creeping in, because you're absolutely right that it is a place where there's a lot of expectation and pretty high stakes, you know, like with a hobby, if you try it and it doesn't work, you know, whatever, then you go return those art supplies to Michaels, or you go return your rock climbing gear to REI, you know, no big deal. But in career, it does have a much bigger set of consequences if something doesn't quite go how you planned and how you wanted it to. So the way that I think about taking risks and trying new things in your career that can open up learning opportunities and fun and growth potential is thinking about ways to set up small scale tests and experiments to try things out to see how they work. So instead of betting everything on making this one transition into something that's totally new when you've never tried working in that sector or working in a job like that, see if there are ways that you could let yourself dip your pinky toe into the water of that work without making it such a life or death kind of a situation that then you have the space and the time and the permission to see how that can feel for you and can be for you. You know, when you think about the risk and the reward as being much lower stakes, it can feel so much easier to try something out. And I'll tell you an example of how I did that in my own career. So I worked for a decade in digital marketing and communications strategy consulting. So I was working at one of those big consulting firms and having tons of clients and, you know, having to bill to the quarter hour and was on my email all the time and sitting in these meetings with important stakeholders. And on the outside, it totally looked successful and glamorous and cool. You know, my job was paying for me to do all this travel. I was on the track to be a vice president by the age of 28. You know, it was super dreamy looking. And if that was something that was really important to me and part of my core values, I know that there is a way. I don't know what that way would have been, but I know there's a way I could have worked that into where my career and my path took me. But the more that I was working in that job, the more I realized that I was really unhappy. I felt like it was soulless. It felt like I was not getting a sense of community, being at home. It felt like I wasn't getting to have deep relationships with my clients the way that I wanted to, because we were just, you know, churning them out and trying to get the work done as quickly as possible. And so I wanted to try out something new. And when I was thinking about the things I loved at my job, I loved working with my coworkers, I loved my direct reports, and I loved talking to people about what was going on in their work and in their life and talking about personal brands and big dreams and all this stuff. And so I got this idea in my head that the natural way to turn that from being, you know, whatever it was, 10% of how I was spending my daily time at work into something more like 75 or 100% of my time was to go and become a therapist, because then I'm talking to people all day, all the time. I get to have these long, deep relationships. We get to have juicy, meaty, meaningful conversations. So I went, took the GRE, applied to grad school, got into grad school, and then telling everybody that I was going to go get my master's in clinical mental health counseling. And then the day before grad school started, 24 hours, I had this fear and this thought creep into my mind that said, are you sure? Going to grad school is a huge investment of time and money and sweat equity. And what happens if you pop out on the other side of this and you hate doing the work of being a therapist? And I thought, oh my gosh, this is so scary. I don't know what to do. And then exactly like what I was just talking about with having a small scale experiment or a way to dip your pinky toe in, I thought, you know what? I could totally volunteer for a crisis text line. You know, I'll defer my enrollment. And I'll go volunteer and I'll see what that's actually like to be working with people when they're in the trenches, in the thick of things, to see how that feels as a career for me. So I started my volunteer work. And after a year of volunteering with them, it became abundantly clear that these two things were true. Number one, I loved doing that work and having those conversations with people. And number two, there was no way I could do that as a career. It was so intense and it was so emotionally draining for me. And I got so emotionally involved with everybody that I knew if I was just doing a 4-hour volunteer shift a week, that there was no way I could do that as 40 hours a week.
So what did you decide to do after you realized that wasn't for you? Where did you go from there?
So I did a couple things. What I first started with doing was moving into a different full-time job that felt less painful and less draining for me. So I made a transition over to a different company. But then I also went back to the drawing board to say, okay, I'm not starting over at zero because I have more information, but I feel like I need to come back to reevaluate what my options are. And when I realized that, you know, I loved having these deep, juicy conversations with people in the context of work, all of a sudden that opened up a new possibility of maybe I'm meant to talk to people about career stuff. So then I started another pinky toe project, which was putting out a shingle as a career coach to see if anybody was willing to pay me for the kinds of things that I had been doing for free for the past decade of my career. And I slowly got one client, and then I got two clients. And then I got it to the point where I had built up a business over the course of, you know, a year, year and a half, where I had enough of a business on the side that I could quit my full-time job and focus exclusively on my entrepreneurial endeavor. So it was not an overnight success. It was not instant knowledge or feedback, but it was by being methodical and having a process and giving myself opportunities to try things out that I finally got to the point of crafting a business and a career and a life that feels like it fits and feels amazing.
Wow. So then when you were even learning how to be a coach, I mean, you have already done this, like you said, for 10 years in your job, but how did you approach it in a way that you didn't let perfectionism stop you from not being a quote unquote good enough coach or doing it the right way?
That's such a wise question, Vicky. I love it. And it's true that whenever you're trying and starting out at something new, that there is this real moment when you know the magnitude of the things that you don't know. And you kind of freak out a little bit and you think, oh my gosh, am I ever going to bridge that gap?
Yeah.
Am I ever going to be good enough, smart enough, experienced enough? You know, are people going to trust me enough? And the things that were really helpful for me were, number one, you know, coming back to integrity. Because you remember how we were talking about this integrity and fear interplay that can have you totally stuck?
Yes.
I came back to my integrity and I said, okay, given where I am in my growth and learning, what feels like it's in integrity for me to do? You know, what rate does it feel in integrity for me to be charging people, knowing that I'm not at the level of coaches who are charging $500 an hour or $1,000 an hour? So what's the rate that feels good for me given the type of things that I think I can help people with and the level of service that I think I can do now? But I also remembered that this is a process, and growth and learning are part of the process, and they only come with time and experience. And so I was really gentle with myself to say, okay, I encountered a question today that I didn't know how to answer. So instead of beating myself up and saying, oh, you should have known the answer to that, how can I focus on the growth and say, okay, how do I look up more information or resources to share with that person so that they can be taken care of and I can feel an integrity and not put the pressure on myself to have to know every single thing up front? You know, because anybody who is starting to learn something new, whether it's rock climbing or playing violin or career coaching, had to start somewhere before they got to the levels of capability and fame and, you know, whatnot that they have these days. So just remembering that everybody, even those $1,000 an hour coaches, they all started out where I was at one point, and it's all just part of the journey, was actually super comforting.
Yeah. And I mean, playing into the whole thing of perfectionism, it's also understanding and accepting when you need help too. It doesn't make you imperfect for needing help. It makes you human.
Oh my goodness. That's so true.
And when you're starting a coaching business or a podcast or anything, it's like you have to realize when you need to reach out to someone else to help you build your vision, to reach that standard that you want for yourself that would make you happy.
100%. And it's funny because there's so many areas in life where we are totally okay asking for help, you know, and for each of us, it's different. You know, for some of us, it was academia and having teachers and tutors and teaching assistants and study groups. You know, for some of us, it's health that we feel totally comfortable with going to the doctor or going to a nutritionist or working with a personal trainer.
Yeah.
But everybody, to get to the level that's possible for their potential and for their capability, everybody uses help. Like, oh my gosh, LeBron James certainly does not play without a coach, without a nutritionist and a personal trainer, and probably who knows other types of people helping him out.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has these amazing teams. And I think that's one of the interesting things about being any type of entrepreneur of any sort, or just being a human being. Like, it helps to have a team of people rooting for you who believe in your vision and want to see it through with you.
Absolutely. And on that flip side too, it also helps to remember that you've never always gotten everything right. You know, we've all screwed stuff up in our lives and we've all lived to tell the tale of it. So knowing that you can take risks and you can mess stuff up and you can still survive, and that you already intuitively know how to fix things, make them better, you know, repair them, change them, whatever needs to happen, can be a super empowering piece of this too.
It really is. And oh man, it's so freeing once you get used to it. I think it's just a matter of practicing it little by little each day, going back to your whole concept of, you know, the little pinky toe experiment. Just dip yourself into it slowly. It's not something you have to go head first in. Because I mean, it's you're saying before, you know, these things take time. It's gradual.
Absolutely. It is gradual and everything is progress. Just because it doesn't turn out sort of quote unquote successful like you had thought it would or like you'd expected it would does not mean it's not progress and growth and learning. Sometimes screwing things up is the biggest gift we can give ourselves because it can change the way that we view ourselves and our capability and our resilience.
Definitely. So for other people who are in their early 20s, who are graduating college or mid-20s, 30s, or wherever, deciding that they want to do something else, do you have any advice that you usually tell your clients when they tell you about something that they have a little bit of analysis paralysis with?
Well, when folks feel like they're totally wrapped around the axle in their brains like that, and they are in analysis paralysis overdrive, what I encourage folks to do is very much in the spirit and the style of Mel Robbins and her 5-second rule, which is, if you can carve out 5 minutes right now to do one single thing that could help you to move even a centimeter, even a millimeter closer to whatever that thing is that you want, let yourself just do it. One of my biggest mantras, which I'm sure is very controversial and which I learned from an old boss of mine many moons ago, is think less, act more. Think less, do more. So when you're noticing yourself going into analysis paralysis, see what you can do to turn your brain off and just act, whether that is registering for a class, whether that's sending an email or a text or giving somebody a call, whether that is lacing up your shoes and getting outside for a walk, whether that is pressing record on your phone to record the first version of your own podcast. You know, give yourself permission for 5 minutes to think less, do more, and just take any kind of action. And that momentum can be really, really powerful.
Taking that little step, I mean, what do you have to lose? It's 5 minutes of your day.
Totally, totally. And, you know, oftentimes in that moment where you're trying to look at those 5 minutes, this fabulous coach named Kate Svoboda said this so beautifully. So often we give ourselves that space and that openness to do the thing, our brains will come in and try to sabotage us by saying, I don't know what I want to do. and Kate said it so perfectly. She said, yes, you do. You're trying to say that you don't know because it gives you that get out of jail free card of not having to do anything. But if you really think about that goal and what you want in the world, you know what you need to do. If you really, really want to write a book, you know what you need to do. It's not spend 16 more hours percolating on that character.
Yeah.
It is putting that pen to paper or putting those fingers to keyboard and just starting to write.
This is something that I try to tell myself and anyone who will listen, really. and it's pretty much, if you limit yourself to small ideas because it makes you feel safe, because you think it'll stop you from failing, you're doing yourself a disservice by selling yourself short. If you sell yourself short and you only say, I am capable of doing this, but you have so much more, you're putting the ceiling on yourself.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Absolutely. And you're being super selfish, right? Like if you're thinking only about yourself, then you're only focusing on you. But what we do in the world, so much is about relationship and connection and service. And if you're thinking about, you know, well, how could I help? Or what are the ways in which I might be able to make a contribution? Or what could I envision doing to serve somebody? Rather than, you know, this is my box, this is my space, this is what I know to be my capability, then you're going to be so much more able to create the relationships and the connections and the business opportunities and the potential and the fun that you want in your life. So changing it from being about all about you and what people might think about you if you fail,
mm-hmm.
to what you've got to give and what challenges are big enough and exciting enough to deserve your big, beautiful brain and heart and energy and time is a really fun thing to do.
It is. And talking to you about this, it brings so much positivity and more insight. Actually, perfect timing. How can people find you, or if they did want to look into your coaching services or just, you know, read more about this?
Mm. Well, if your listeners are the sort of folks that are readers, then I have a fabulous thing that I would love to share. I have a document that I call my not so secret weapons, and it is the list of the books and podcasts and coaches and classes and courses that have totally changed and transformed my life and my happiness and my career. Ooh. And I would love to share those with you listening to the podcast. So if that's something that anybody here would be interested in, you can check out all of my work at my website at lisalewiscareers.com. It's Lisa, L-I-S-A, Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, careers.com. And if you want to get a version of that not-so-secret weapons list, you can go to lisalewiscareers.com/adulting.
Awesome. How perfect. I love that resource.
Yeah, it's been such a journey and such an evolution, and I've grown so, so much over, you know, this part of my life and my career so far, that I'm sure I will still be adding to that secret weapon list for many, many years. But I am always happy to share the things that have helped me to grow and to think about things the way that I do for anybody else who's on the same journey.
It's awesome. Well, thank you again so much for coming onto the show. It was definitely fun. I hope this encouraged you guys to be a little bit more, you know, take it easy. Thank you again for going on the show, Lisa.
You are so welcome. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Yeah, of course. Okay, guys, so tune in next week to Adulting with Vicky while we explore another topic on navigating adulthood. Bye.
As always, thank you for tuning in to Adulting with Vicky. I'm continually working hard to improve the show, so if you have any feedback or topic ideas or want advice on anything, you can get in contact with me online at victoriadnguyen.com or hello.victoriadnguyen@gmail.com. Intro remix courtesy of Shadow. Find him on Instagram as elshadow, that's ELSHDW. You can also keep up with me via Instagram. My handle is victoriadnguyen_. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to hit that subscribe button. And if you have a minute, it would mean so much to me if you would rate and write a review for the show. Thank you so much again, guys. I'll talk to you next week.